Hey, this is Lucas, and I'm here with Dane and Sean, and we're gonna talk a bit. Was that that's like the weirdest intro, sort of like I'm greeting.
Have you never done this before?
An ex-girlfriend or something. Hello, I feel awkward. Hey, how you guys doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Snow's starting to melt over here.
Oh my goodness, it's like 100,000 degrees here in Texas.
Yeah, it's hot here.
Oh dear.
You have hot hair?
It's hot here.
Oh, okay.
It is warm.
I don't know. Well, if you're standing in the sun, you would have hot hair. It's shorts. Yeah, it's shorts weather all the way here. And since it's East Texas, it's also sleeveless weather, but that's pretty much all year. Just no sleeves.
That's all year.
But you don't buy a sleeveless shirt. That's silly. What you do is you take a perfectly normal shirt and you cut the sleeves off of it, but like in a ragged way. And then that's really, really Texan.
You got to give it character.
Yeah, but I don't feel like I've ever seen you do that, Sean. You came down from Canada and you have not transitioned to the sleeveless.
No, look. I'm sorry. That's just too trashy for me.
It's not trashy.
It is.
It's a beautiful kind of
for
thing.
Me. For you, it's very appropriate.
It's perfect for me. Okay, hey, let's read the Bible now that you've been mean. Okay, verse of the day. Do you guys get the verse of the day on your, do you do a Bible app or something?
No.
Yeah, I've got it, I think.
Sean, you don't do a Bible app?
I don't, no.
What do you mean?
I just don't open my Bible.
You don't have any kind of app that is the Bible?
I have a Bible app in case I forget my Bible and I go to church and, you know, just in case, but I don't know that I've ever even used it.
What? Dane, is that, I mean, am I crazy?
No love for the Bible app.
I
use more often than not. I used to use a physical Bible, like exclusively, but over the years I've been like using like the Bible app, the YouVersion Bible app, and a couple other ones, but through, what is that?
I'm sorry. I accidentally hit some person speaking on the YouVersion app as you're talking about the YouVersion app.
Yeah. So, to answer your question, I use a digital Bible quite often, but I still have and will use a physical one, but I find myself more gravitating towards the digital one that I kind of have on me.
Yeah. I mean, because you're not insane, you know? I mean, like, why would you be carrying around an archaic codex when you could? I mean, like, how many translations do I have here? I probably am in my pocket carrying like 200 English translations, not to mention German and French. Anyway, let's read this verse. It's 2 Corinthians 4:18.
Uh-huh.
So if you guys want to look it up in your archaic and digital versions, feel free. I'm trying to see if I hear pages turning. Sean, are you turning pages or are you just going to?
No, this I have open at BibleGateway.com.
Oh,
yeah.
So you do use the app.
I'm sitting in front of my computer.
Oh, this is going to confuse people. It's terrible. Okay. 2 Corinthians 4:18 says this. So we do not focus on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. I mean, I guess my response is, yep, that's true. I mean, I don't have anything in particular to say about it. Wait a minute, did it say what is unseen is eternal?
You just raised this verse for no reason. I thought there was going to be a big revelation
day. It's the verse of the day.
So I think because I have the Bible app or whatever on my phone, I have a widget on my screen. So I think I did see this verse earlier today. And it did make me think about something I talked about in my latest video on YouTube with talking about what is faith. And anyways, I'm not sure if this is like an exact like connecting point for it or not, but while we do not look at things which are seen, but at the things which, while we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. And And if I'm remembering this correctly, the verse just in front of this, yeah, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory.
I know that one too.
This reminds me of the idea in Hebrews 11:1. Faith is the evidence of things not seen, the substance of things hoped for. I'm really botching that, but
made me think of that too, though. Yeah, I was thinking of that. I bet Sean could quote it.
That idea kind of resonates with me, I think, because after I made that video, I get a lot of comments and stuff sometimes, usually saying like how I'm an idiot, but that's okay.
That's not true. Well, really, people are telling you mean things
sometimes, but anyways, one of the things was from, I assume, an atheist, and he quoted Hebrews 11:1 and emphasized the unseen and hope for in it, and recognized it was his emphasis added. And then kind of, I guess he might have missed how I explained it in the video, if you watch like the whole thing over. But the whole idea was that a lot of Christians can get the wrong impression that that faith involves, you know, like, oh, we're walking blindly and like we're just kind of, you know, wishful thinking our way through life type of thing. But in that verse in particular, like it's revolving around this idea of reward and rulership alongside the king that is available in the future. And those things we don't see right now, but it's not like it's wishful thinking to that's going to happen. Like, no, like we're convinced that that is in the future based on the things that we already are sure of and know of, based on God's demonstrated faithfulness in the past. And since he's the one that's promising this, this as a possibility for faithful believers in the future, we're looking ahead. And in that sense, we're walking by faith, where we're walking and looking towards something that we don't see here and now, which is temporary, but to the thing that's promised, which is eternal. And I think that kind of ties into what this verse of the day is talking about, with what we see right now is gonna fade, but there's something that's coming that we don't see yet, and that is eternal.
Yeah.
That's
good. That made me think of, I was kind of having this, I've been like neck deep in making illustrations and charts for Revelation this week, because I'm working on a book about it. But so I'm thinking in terms of like I've got that switch flipped in my head of like, how do we chart this? How do we make a diagram of this? And what I was just thinking is, okay, so imagine a diagram where now, N-O-W, is in the middle. And that's the dividing line between beliefs realized and beliefs hoped for. You know, on the left, it's kind of like a timeline. It's like everything before now, things that we believe, you know, they're things that we believe about the past, so to speak, would be like beliefs realized. It'd be like, I believe the sky is blue because I've seen it. And the wall's hard because I hit my head on it, and, you know, whatever. But then what shifts at the now, as you go along that timeline, is like there are beliefs that will continue to be evidence based, but there's beliefs that are not yet realized. But I think what challenges people is they think that those are of a different substance, that like a belief about the evidential stuff is of a different essence than a belief about a hoped for thing, but they're not. They're like, the belief itself is the same thing. It's being convinced. It's knowing that the thing's true, you know? Mm. And so the difference is just the evidence. We have textual evidence for things coming in the future. We have, you know, it's kind of a relational trust in the one whose words are recorded in the Bible. So that's the beliefs hoped for, but not yet seen. you know, that that are like shoot out past that now point. So anyway, I don't know. I'm not going to take the time to diagram that, but it's just kind of what was, as you were talking about it, it's kind of what I was seeing was like this, this dividing, you know, this dividing line.
Yeah, no, that makes
Sean,
sense.
Do you have any, you have any thoughts on this, or have you gone to sleep?
I'm looking at the whole chapter 4 in 2
Corinthians. Oh yeah, you know, overachiever. I don't use no, Bible apps, and I read the whole chapter. That's
well,
what I'm
he's talking about renouncing secret and shameful things. He's talking about people who are perishing. He's talking about that we have treasures in jars of clay so that God's power can be displayed. He's talking about we're afflicted in every way, verse 8, but not crushed. We're perplexed, but not in despair. We're persecuted, but not abandoned. We're struck down, but not destroyed. Isn't that a song? And he's talking about all these things. It's basically just a hard life of being of suffering, you know. And in verse 16, he says, but we do not give up. Even though our outer person is being destroyed, our inner person is being renewed day by day. And he talks about light affliction in verse 17. So it's kind of like, I think when he says we don't focus on what's seen, I think he's talking about pastorally Christians who are suffering right now, Christians who can feel in their bodies and in their circumstances that this world is not the way God designed it. That people are getting sick, they're being crushed by poverty, their relationships are being destroyed, they're being persecuted for their faith, they're suffering in 101 different ways, but we don't focus on that. If we focused on that, we would all give up. We'd all end up in a mental asylum. We'd all be permanently depressed. We don't focus on that. What we focus on is kind of what you guys were talking about, the promises of the future, the better promises we have from Christ, knowing that all this outer stuff is going to pass away, but our inner person is not only is being renewed day by day, but really what is also eternal. We're believers, so we're going to live forever. And so the light affliction we have now in light of eternity is going to seem like a blink of an eye. So we don't focus on now. Our motivation comes from what's going to be true of us forever and ever and ever. So I think this is about perspectives on affliction.
I like Lucas and I were we were kind of focusing and honing in on the things that are coming that are that even though we don't see right now are sure. But I like how you kind of dove into the what's happening in the temporary, the things that are seen, like it's like suffering and hardship and stuff, which is to be expected in this life, especially as we try to walk in sync with God. And yeah, that reminds me of also like Romans 8, where the things just the whole creation groaning and the joint heirship with Christ being conditioned on you know, living life and experiencing the suffering that comes along with actually, you know, walking in his ways, not because his ways are bad, but because his ways in this life are hostile to the way things are in this present evil age, quote unquote. And so, yeah, I agree that, yeah, the temporary stuff that is being talked about is definitely in view of like the suffering and the hardships and the stuff that we face here and now.
I was having a another mental image while you were talking. Actually, both of y'all, I was kind of going on. It's like, take something. There's a movie that does this. Okay, I think it's called Romancing the Stone. Oh, I'm going to do this from memory, but I think it's in that movie where there's this clay statue, but inside of it is this really precious stone that, you know, is very old or whatever, ancient, very valuable stone. And the statue itself, they have to break to get that, you know, to get that stone out. And I kind of wonder if that is a good analogy for, like, you know, the stuff on the outside is little bits are breaking off, the paint's coming off, the, you know, it's kind of melting away. But inside there's this refined stone that's going to be there at the end. You know, I don't know. I guess that kind of is similar to 1 Corinthians 3, where it talks about, like, you know, at the end of your life, we're going to test it by fire and we'll see what still remains, you know.
With that made me think of, I've thought about this for a little while now, but the idea of like receiving the free gift of everlasting life, and that's something that believers have as a present possession, but what we still also have is this mortal weak body. And the way I've kind of been thinking about it is in terms of, like, at the rapture, or like when we receive our resurrection bodies, that's like us receiving a body that's compatible with the life that was granted to us as the gift of God, which is that's suitable for it. That and that just made me think about what you were talking about.
Yeah, it's like, how could, like, this body does not contain well that which lives forever, and that which can probably transcend the kind of experience we have now. You know, it's wrapped up inside there, but it's not a good container for it. You know, it's going to
why do you say that? Like, how different will our bodies be?
Well, you know, I think what I'm talking about is the propensity to sin.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I'm not talking about like, will we fly or not? I don't know.
Thought you might be going, like, how much different will the body be? Do you think?
Well, some people think, some people think it will be
to eternal life.
I'm undecided on that factor, but, but as far as just like the reason it's not a good fit is like, okay, it's like, you have a car, but the car has this mind of its own and it always wants to drive to the strip bar, you know? Yeah. But inside, the driver is trying to go to church, you know? And it's like, you're fighting the car, you know? And, you know, so it's like, it's not a good wrapper for the inner man, or that seed that cannot sin, because the exterior wants to steer away from what the interior wants, you know? And so, So to come in harmony, to have flesh that comes in harmony with the spirit at the resurrection, I don't think we can really comprehend what that experience will be like. I mean, I don't know. It's quite unique. But Sean, you seem kind of triggered by the body will be different. What's going on there?
I've been thinking that because. No, just because so many people think that salvation is you're just a soul floating in heaven or whatever, in the vision of God, the beatific vision. But, like, as biblical Christians, we're committed to the idea that, no, we're spending eternity in bodies.
Yeah, our body, yeah.
These bodies. Mm-hmm. And, like, what is the difference? Like, that we don't age or don't get sick? But otherwise, I mean, what? Am I still only going to be able to, like, you know, deadlift a certain amount of weight and I'll never really be able to surpass that? You know, are we still going to have all the limitations of our body? And so I was just curious if those were the types of limitations you were mentioning.
You know, I have some theories on that, but I'm trying to decide if it's worth going into.
Well, some people console themselves by thinking we'll get some type of superhero type abilities, like Jesus being able to pass through walls, like Kitty Pryde from the X-Men.
Popular thought, yeah.
So it's like, I don't know, is that going to be true? I mean, I don't know. I've been seeing
it would be cool.
it'd be cool.
But also, I mean, I would say, you know, I mean, so what they'll usually lean on is, you know, verse that says, we'll be like Christ. And I mean, I think the thing for me is, we will be like Christ in some meaningful ways, but there's probably other ways that we will not be like Christ even then. Like, for instance, we didn't exist from before time began. So we will be meaningfully different in some ways, but meaningfully the same. And so I think that when he says we'll be like Christ, he doesn't really specify which parts of us are going to be like what aspect that is. And it very well may be that we can fly and pass through walls. However, my theory, which I put in one of my books, is that You know how Paul says we will judge angels? Mm-hmm. I have this is almost a sci-fi fantasy thought. It's just kind of an idea that, like, what if the arrangement is we will be put in charge of, we will be, our station will be slightly above angels. And I don't know why that would be, but let's say that's the case. But then it makes sense to me that we might would partner with angels for some of those things that, like, if I need to fly somewhere, well, can an angel carry me? We have, even in scripture, we have examples of angels, like, moving people from place to place, you know? And so, so I don't know. I kind of tend to think, like, our bodies might be fairly natural in the way that we think of it, obviously not dying, but that we would have access to other abilities through these other creatures that God has made that can do those things, that we already know can do those things. Of course, he could just change us. I mean, that could be, I don't know. It's kind of fun to think about, but
yeah.
Yeah. Hey, what are y'all working on? What projects y'all got going?
So right now I am working on I think at this point it's like a 9-part series on apologetics, trying to walk my target audience is trying to find someone who is more of a highly intellectual, like, rational thinker who is openly, like, curious and seeking the possibility of a God. And I am trying to build that from the ground up, leading all the way basically to the gospel message. And so, yeah, so it's dives a little bit into some philosophical stuff at the beginning and then breaks its way through scripture and all that kind of stuff. But the first episode, a little teaser, I guess, is going to be exploring the first 4 words of the Bible. And so, and so that'll kind of kick it off. First episode's written, haven't recorded it yet, but I'm working on the second episode and I've got kind of like a blueprint laid out for the series.
Cool. Yeah, I like that. In the beginning, God, I think, is the first 4 words.
Correct.
Did I get them right? Okay. See, I'm already on board with you. I already know the content. Yeah, that's cool. I like that idea of, like, starting from, from the ground. In seminary, there was, so when I started seminary, I started as an apologetic student, and then I bailed on that because I wanted to do something different. But I remember one of the debates that came up, kind of like internal debates, was something like, I don't remember what the terms were, but something like the one-step method of just, you start with Jesus, and that's the beginning of that's the beginning of the content. But the other method is you start with creation, and you build up and try to prove there's a creator, and there's more steps to that, because you could prove there's a creator, but then someone could say, and it's Vishnu, or some other. And so I always was interested in, like, why different people chose the approaches they chose. So, like, I'm interested to know for you, why Genesis? Like, why did you start? And this is not a criticism. I'm just wondering what your thinking on it was. Why start with Genesis?
So my thinking is that, I'm trying, because the target audience that I'm going for is someone who can fall either into the, like, skeptic category, or someone who thinks in rational and logic is, like, their first thing. They're not super, emotionally feely type of people. They generally have questions. They want things to make sense. They're seeking for truth through that lens. And the way that I think it's helpful is is one, the way that the Bible kind of unfolds itself. But one interesting angle that I'm trying to go through here is, I said the first episode is in the beginning God, which is true, but there is a slight small intro video that introduces the series, and it's for efficiency seekers. If you want to know the truth,
like,
and
that.
And you want to know which, if there is a God, like, and which God is it, like, there's so many religions and everything. What I've told people in the past is that the Bible makes a very interesting and helpful claim that the God of the Bible is the only and one true God. And so if that is true, then that eliminates a lot of time and energy spent exploring all these hundreds of different things. So, so like the thought is like, okay, if you really want to look into it and you want to save some time, why don't you start with that? And if you find out that it's true, search is over. If you're still unconvinced, then you can, you know, do your thing. But that leaves the door open for them to like, okay, well, this could be efficient. Let's at least try it or whatever. And then I try to walk through the progression of, you know, how everything comes to be and all this kind of stuff.
I like that. Yeah. Cause that's, I mean, one way to think of that would be like, you know, can I investigate every religion in the world? Probably not. Probably don't really have the time or bandwidth to do that, but I could eliminate all that are inclusive and just look at the ones that are exclusive. Cause the ones that are exclusive and say, we have the, you know, we have the truth and no one else does. Those would be the ones to start with, because if they're right, then you save the time. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm glad you're working on that. You know, we when I started doing apologetics videos, I haven't done that in a long time, but when I started, I thought that the plan really was to minister to atheists or something. And that didn't turn out to really be what we did. What we wound up doing mostly was ministering to believers who were just kind of being bombarded by, you know, atheist arguments or whatever.
Yeah. Yes.
Which that's good too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not like you have to really pick, you know, I mean, it's just, you'll do it naturally. I mean, it's just what'll happen maybe, or maybe it won't. Maybe you'll actually figure out how to find a core of open-minded agnostics or something. You know, I like that you're looking for those who really are seeking the truth. I just can say the internet doesn't have any of those. So
I think, so to your point, Lucas, I wonder, I was really into apologetics when I was a new Christian in college.
Yeah.
And I have a book on it out there, Scripturalism and the Senses. But I thought, at the end of the day, apologetics is really more for discipleship. It's for shoring up the faith of Christians. Yeah. And usually you come to faith for some other reason. You know, you come to faith, and everyone has a slightly different story, but it's usually not because you were convinced of, you know, Thomas Aquinas's five ways to God or whatever. It's usually because something else happened. And then when you're challenged by atheists and your faith gets shaken, apologetics is really important for like stabilizing your faith, making you realize, this is rational. This makes sense. The alternative worldviews do not make sense.
Yeah.
Like, how did you guys come to faith because of the conclusion of a rational argument, or
was
it something else?
No, it's because I trusted my parents.
Okay. You trusted your parents.
And
okay.
a lot of people like try to hide that and pretend like they came to it rationally. But no, I mean, I surmise that my parents were trustworthy to the extent that I was able to assess them. And like, you know, I like, well, those two grown-ups believe this, so I believe that. That doesn't make it right or wrong. Like, a lot of people complain about that. That doesn't make it right or wrong. That just means that's, you know, that's how I approached it. You know,
and I mean, really, the Bible is like, parents, you're supposed to teach your children this, you know? So that's really the normal way, you know, that's the ideal way. What about you, Dane? How did it happen for you?
Yeah. Mine, birthed more out of a dire fear of hell.
Okay.
yeah. I, And my testimony timeline is a bit iffy because I, like, growing up, all I remember is wrestling with doubts and being scared type of thing. And so, I mean, unless it was a time like when I was really young and I just like was flooded with doubts after the fact, the first time that I could remember like being like, you know, like I'm going to heaven was actually like in Bible college. But what got me really seeking and just, you know, my mind really engaged in trying to figure all this out was like, man, I'm terrified of being sent to hell. And I was the type of kid that would, rehearse like, you know, the quote unquote sinner's prayer like hundreds of times type of thing, because just not knowing like how to go about looking into the Bible myself and just being surrounded by things you hear from like churches or the radio or whatever, and oftentimes it's just like all of the, you know, fire and brimstone type of stuff. And so I was just naturally like terrified and just wanted to how do I escape that. So I'm very appreciative of the gift.
I had a phase like
wait
that
wait
too.
So may I ask sorry Lucas,
yeah, go ahead.
So Dane, what you're saying is you had an existential fear, an existential need, and the freeness of the gospel was made sense of, not made sense of your fear, but answered that existential need, basically.
Yeah, like it helped me put things actually into perspective of like, wow, like something can be done about, something has been done about this, and it's freely available to me. So it was just like, that's kind of how that unfolded over the time. This timeline can get a little spotty, I guess, but yeah, that's kind of the initial, what triggered the initial search for me, I guess.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say I had a similar phase, but it was after I had believed. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, I believed my parents when I was young and therefore believed Jesus because my parents said I could. Mm-hmm. And that was legit. But then I kind of was in circles with some, I didn't know it at the time, but some pretty strong Calvinist leanings, mm-hmm. which I suspect really strong Arminian leanings would probably do the same thing, but they started, it allowed these certain questions to crop up that didn't have satisfactory answers to me. And it kind of led me to this place where I remember praying every night, multiple times, something like the sinner's prayer, like, you know, Lord, forgive me. And I couldn't even say of what. I mean, I was like 12, you know, what had I even done that I needed forgiveness for? I didn't know. I just knew I was supposed to pray for forgiveness, and I didn't know how to know that I'd had it, you know. But that was apart from the original belief of just Jesus just saved me, you know. And it was kind of like after the fact confusion. On the subject of, now this is really unpopular. What I'm about to say is really unpopular with atheists, but I think it does kind of answer a thing. I've done some research on this with some surveys, that in the same way that I think most people don't come to faith by intellectual arguments, I don't think they leave the faith for intellectual arguments either. And that is actually something I did some surveys on a few years ago. My premise was that I suspected that the intellectual arguments were the last step in a de-churching phase, like a secularization phase. And so what the surveys that, and I'm not an expert survey giver. I'm not a statistician or a sociologist. So I might have been baiting with some of the questions, but for the ones that actually answered, what it found was that over a period of a few years, a lot of times what would happen is someone would get involved in something that the church called sin, and then they would start to isolate from other believers. Mm. And there's a few steps in there, but the final step was kind of this intellectual gloss over. And the way that I came to see it was that's a way of saving your dignity as you, instead of admitting I morally failed at being a Christian. And let's remember that most of these folks are not coming from grace backgrounds. They're coming from performance-based backgrounds. And so they're like, well, I'm failing and it's uncomfortable to fail. And these people, I feel judged and, you know, and so then they start to turn it around and they start to say, well, they're the hypocrites and you know, they're the ones that are stupid because they can't answer these intellectual questions. It's a way of just like building a wall of self-dignity around basically failing at discipleship. Now you can imagine how that's not a popular thing to say to somebody that's left the faith, you know, but it seemed to be what I was seeing with these surveys. And maybe I should return to that and try to verify that a little bit more. And there's definitely outliers, I think, you know, but there was enough of those that I was like, okay, this is a significant percentage that have followed this, you know? And so, but here's the point though. The point is, if that's true of the person that I'm talking to, then what they need is not a discussion about an intellectual problem with the faith. What they need is something different entirely. And so I came to think of these intellectual arguments as red herrings, just things to distract from the raw nerve that's at the center of why they left the church, why they left the faith, because they don't want to talk about that. And that kind of fits in with what I sometimes call the king reason approach to arguing. Like in chess, you always protect your king. You always, you know, you throw pawns, you throw bishops, you throw rooks at the enemy, but you protect the king. And I think in this circumstance, if someone has left the faith because of, you know, what Jesus calls in parable, you know, thorns and rocks, well, that's embarrassing. And so they're going to protect that reason and they're going to throw other red herrings at the problem and say, oh, it's because of cosmology. Like, what decision in life is really made because of your cosmological stance, you know, or your teleological stance? It's like, that's ridiculous. We don't make decisions on that kind of thing. Most people make decisions based on very personal, very emotional, you know, kind of like factors. And so I just think those are often a way to distract. Not in every case. Not in every case, but in a lot of cases, I think they're a way to distract because they're not really how people make decisions in the real world for the most part. That's the Lucas opinion. I could be way off, but I did do some surveys like 5 years ago, so I obviously know a
okay,
whole lot.
Okay, well, so what you're saying there kind of fits on something I've been working on. I'm working on, I'm supposed to teach at a church in Pennsylvania in the fall on Christian life. And I'm working on the dry title, the academic title. I don't know what the cool title will be, but the dry title is The Moral Psychology of Christian Transformation.
Yeah, you got to change that crap. Don't do that.
That's technically what it's about. But it's about basically how does transformation really happen? And I'm drawing on some people that maybe Free Grace people don't like John Piper's Christian Hedonism, this Scottish Calvinist named Thomas Chalmers, and one of my favorite writers, Paul Zoll, who I recommend highly. And it's really about your life will change when you're not really when you're, you know, it's like you don't choose to just change. You have to be motivated to choose. And so it's like, what is that motivation? And the idea is you're motivated to change by your affections. When your affections change, then your life is going to follow your affections. And so based on, I think it's 1 John, it might be chapter 3, I forget, where it's like you can either love the world or you can love God. And Thomas Chalmers and John Piper have this whole thing where the only way to replace a lesser love is to replace it with a greater love. And so it's like, how do we increase that love for God that kind of relativizes and diminishes our love for the things of this world? And but it's emotion. These are emotional kind of motivations for transformation, not necessarily because we all know adultery is wrong, but why do people commit adultery? Yeah. Because they are after some other type of, you know, there's some heartstring, lesser love type of desire thing that's happening. And yeah. We gotta treat people at the level of desires.
Yeah, that's good.
I'm only at the beginning of that.
I like that. You know, it makes me think of what Jesus said to the Ephesians in Revelation. You said you lost your first love, and what you would expect him to say is, so love me more. But he doesn't. He actually gives them actions to perform.
So
he says, do the first works, you know? So it's like the love follows the action, I think, rather than the other way around.
That is my first lecture. Revelation, the three stages of the Christian life. The three stages are the first love, and then there's a cooling off period, and then you're supposed to return to that first love to get to your renewed love stage. So you have three stages right there in that one sentence. Yeah. And it's like, okay, how do you move from stage two to stage three? And we all do this for anything, for absolutely anything. It could be work. It could be your marriage. It could be, there's always that exciting initial part. And then things start getting routine and start getting cooled off. And then you really have to dig in to kind of find for yourself the true enjoyment, the deep enjoyment. It's like you're like in marriage, you kind of go past that hormonal honeymoon period stage. And then you gotta dig your way into our deep and abiding, true, lasting love for your partner. And I think the same is like with Jesus. It's like there's that exciting time at the beginning and you're doing all kinds of great stuff for the Lord. But then you kind of get into a cooling off period. Maybe you've experienced some disappointments. You don't have as many consolations from the Lord. And you got to push through to that abiding, that third stage, that abiding love.
Yeah. Or you always have the option of becoming lukewarm so that you can be spit out of his mouth.
If you stay lukewarm, spittooey.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Dane is good at titles. He thinks about titles a lot for videos. So maybe he can help you with that.
I was already trying to think of
horrible
like,
title. say the title again, Sean.
It's called The Moral Psychology of Christian Transformation.
And the moral okay. the moral migraine of Messiah-like mentorship.
I was thinking something like the greater love wins or something like that.
That's better. Yeah. Yeah, use emotional words, you know.
Thomas Chalmers' title for his thing is The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. I think I should just go with that.
Fancy.
Sounds, you know, so you mentioned John Piper. I don't know a lot about John Piper, but the things that I've seen, he does talk a lot about love. I think the misapplication, like we should be talking about love and we should be talking about affection. And you know, he uses this flowery language to talk about it. I think the miss with John Piper is just applying that to think that that's how you get salvation. But apart from that, I mean, we definitely need to be thinking about how our affections, you know.
Well, so John Piper's whole moral theory is called Christian hedonism. And it's this idea that we're commanded to delight in the Lord and take joy in the Lord and to enjoy the Lord. It's like we shouldn't be sour-faced Christians. But my objection to John Piper is I'm loving this stuff, but I'm like, this would work so much better if a free grace person was teaching about Christian hedonism, because he is so inconsistent in teaching about work salvation. And even with this joy stuff, the way he talks about it is, well, if you don't have that level of joy, maybe you're not saved at all. You know? And it's like, oh,
and it's
dude,
just, it's such you're a distraction.
Just, yeah, you're shooting yourself in the foot, man. Yeah. It's like, drop the works salvation stuff.
Yeah, it just distracts from it. You know, like I remember a quote from him. It was something like, do you love Jesus more than you love football? And he was talking about how you might not be saved, but you love football more. And I'm like, how do I measure? Like, how do I quantify what my football love is? You know, and how do I quantify what my Jesus love is? I mean, it's
totally
like
subjective.
It's so subjective. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he's not wrong that we should love Jesus more than football. I mean, everybody agrees with that, but it's what is the result of failing at that? And I think our, you know, our difference is just the result of failing of that is you just get up tomorrow and you try again, but you don't lose your salvation, you know?
Well, I would also say John Piper's view of God just will not inspire the kind of love that we're supposed to have. And so
tell me about that. What does that mean?
Well, because it's the kind of God who's like, you might go to hell because you don't, you might love football a little bit too much. You know? It's like, it's like that's the kind of God who's going to inspire the fear that Dane was talking about, you know, that fear of hell. Am I going to go there or not? I think that someone, so we need, they need, I think Christian hedonism, if this is a valid theory, only works if you have a gracious God who shows us one way love, gives us eternal life for free, and is, you know, there's some, maybe some discipline involved, but our, that relationship is unbreakable. That kind of love will inspire love that is greater than the love of football or the world or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. That's, that's how it works in human relationships too. Right. Cause it's like, in like a husband or wife relationship, like a genuine love for the other person doesn't come from the other person threatening to beat them.
Yeah. But, I'm going to beat you.
But like being sacrificial and caring for them and doing things for them and knowing them and all that kind of stuff. That's more motivating than listen here, you.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, that's a really good point that, you know, punishment, and I don't mean discipline, I mean punishment, like, you know, punitive eternity is a factor, but I think it's probably the most effective in the extreme cases. And I think it's so sad that a pastor that could have probably convinced you to believe in Jesus, you know, in a very gentle and loving, under a very gentle and loving image, instead used, you're going to go to hell for eternity. I mean, I do believe that those that reject Christ are going to be separated for eternity and, you know, suffer torment. But it's like, I don't feel like we have to jump to that. I feel like we can, you know, in extreme cases, that is probably part of the narrative that we need to bring out. But most people want to know their creator, you know, most people want to experience, you know, the kindness of the Lord. Think of that little quote in Romans. It says something like, be aware of the kindness and severity of the Lord. If the kindness doesn't work, he can be severe, but we don't always need that, you know? So, I don't know.
I was just going to say that, like if any of the pastors that I remember hearing from, like, about hellfire, were to, you know, explain the grace of God, you know, accurately or clearly, that would have been nice. But I don't think I ever heard that, because the voices that I was hearing were people like John Piper and people that made it about, like, you know, you choosing God or loving him and all of these things that should actually flow from someone who has already, like, been born into his family, not someone who's trying to get in there. Like, oh, I have to love this guy that has authority over my eternal destiny in order to, like, sway him to, you know, in my favor type of thing. Like, I never got the clear solution. I just heard kind of like the problem, and it was more problem oriented. Like, we're the problem. There's problems here, but I never heard, like, the clear actual, like, no, like, God has the solution here. It always seemed like it was in our, like, either our courtyard, so like the ball's in my court type of thing, it was all behavioral type of, like, based, and so I'm just like, what do I do? So
such a challenge, you know. It's, I wonder how much of, so I don't know with John Piper, I wonder how much of what he's doing is really dictated by, you know, Calvinistic or Reform theology, and how much of it is just his own perception. I mean, do y'all know what his stance is? I don't follow him enough.
He's a Calvinist Baptist, loves Jonathan Edwards, Jonathan Edwards scholar. And,
the feet dangler.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Over hell. Yeah. Exactly. Sinners in the hands of an angry God. I mean, that's, there you go. That's, how do you love that God? How does love for that God displace love for the world?
Since we were talking about apologetics earlier, part of me thinks that, like, a lot of the things that people have issues with God is because they hear secondhand bad representations of what God is actually like.
Yeah, probably true.
Which is kind of like my idea that or my theory. It's probably not original, but obviously a lot of people will throw these caricatures of what God is like. And I'm like, but that's not what the Bible
says.
That's not
who we're saying he is. Yeah, so that's true.
My worship leader, and he's my associate pastor, his name's Fanny Abu Hamid. We're thinking about doing a kind of conference at our church, maybe in association with FGI, or I expect it to be kind of on this theme of deconstruction. I'm not sure of that word, but with this idea, it's when people deconstruct from the faith, I suspect they're deconstructing from a legalistic works righteousness, horrible view of God. And it's like, you should deconstruct from that because it's not true. And here's, I don't know what the opposite term would be, rediscovery, reconstruction, rediscover grace. Here's the overhaul. Grace message. Overhaul. Yeah. Yeah. It's like there are atheists who reject, you know, God. And I sometimes ask, you guys have probably heard this before. It's like, tell me about the God you don't believe in, because I probably don't believe in him either. You know, it's like, just because I'm a theist doesn't mean I believe in every type of version of deity. And there are some there are wrong ones out there, and I don't believe those either.
The Christian tent is so broad, you know, and I don't know, there's a lot that people have rejected without outright, I mean baby with the bathwater kind of situation. I kind of wonder, how often has someone rejected the organization that they grew up with but by proxy has not really rejected Christ, but they just have avoided all Jesus related things because it was so distasteful to them, you know? And I don't know, there's probably, probably
that's
a lot
kind
of
what
that.
That's kind of like the hope with that series that I'm working on is like, okay, well, if we started from scratch and we went from the very beginning of how the Bible defines and describes God and work our way from there and just let that kind of unfold, then that should like remove the obstacles of the, you know, caricature versions of God.
Yeah,
like
I like
a big mean guy in the sky type of deal. Like, no, we're talking about a being that is like incredibly and like mind-bogglingly in a different category altogether than we are.
Yeah.
And that's where it starts. And so I just think that, and I do know some people that are like that. I know that, hopefully Luke's survey doesn't mean I'm wasting my time.
No. Yeah. I hope that's not what I'm. Yeah.
No,
there's always a place for talking about these things. You know, there's always a place for it. What it might mean is just the target audience that you mentioned, you may realize, you know, a year into it that, oh, I'm actually reaching different people than I thought I was going to reach. But you're still reaching people. Yeah. If you're talking about, you know, if you're talking about the Lord, you're going to reach people. It's just what happens. So.
Yeah. And no, I was just messing with you there. So that's the whole kind of like the idea of like, okay, let's remove all of the baggage and the misrepresentations and kind of like just open up and just run through the Bible kind of rapidly and some logical things that come with that. And at least that provides a resource on the channel there that someone stumbling across, like wanting to investigate Christianity or the Bible or, you know, like who is God type of thing. Hopefully it can give them like a map or like a guide, and they can travel that road with that through that playlist or whatever.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, and that actually becomes valuable in comment section, because you start to see that the same kind of questions coming up when you're doing online, you know, social media oriented stuff. And so it actually saves you a bunch of time, because you can just say, oh, I made a thing on that. Here's the thing, you know. So, hey, you guys, we're at 54 minutes, and it usually takes us about 5 to 6 minutes to get off this thing. So why don't we do a wrap up? Hey, who has the dog? Is that Sean?
Yeah, I was gonna say, should I turn my volume down? That's our little dog upstairs.
I didn't know y'all had a dog. What is it?
It's a problem. That's what it is. I don't even know what it's like. A little frou-frou dog. His name is Max.
I hadn't known that. That's cool, Max.
Technically, it's my mother-in-law's dog.
Oh, okay. Well, so we can now say that Max was on the podcast too.
Indeed,
so
we'll
include him. All right, any final thoughts, Sean?
You know, if you're being discouraged by the stuff that's around you, just remember to shift your perspective that, you know, this is fading away and what eternal is going to last forever. So focus on what is unseen, but eternal.
You know what, Sean, I had a thought that I was going to say earlier, but then so this is why it takes 5 minutes to get off. Cause I always go, but on the subject of replacing, replacing with a greater love. What I was thinking of when you were talking about that is pets, actually. And since Max is barking, this is a good fit. I had a cat when I was single that he was like pretty close to the center of my world. It was like Jesus and then Lynx and then every other human, you know. Lynx was the name of the cat. And I mean, I just loved him and was very defensive about him and just, you know, but then when was still that way, even after I was married, by the way, which is a little sad, but was, you know, but when we had kids, the love for the kids, they did not make me not love the cat. It was like they made my ability to love so much more capacious. It just increased the size of the love tank or whatever to where I still loved the cat the same amount. But I realized at that time, it's actually a very small amount compared to how much I can love my child.
Oh, yeah, you know? Yeah. I have observed many times on social media, especially, you know, earlier in my life, when a girl especially was single, she'd post lots of, this is not just one girl, it's across many girls, they'd post a lot of puppy pictures and cat pictures. But then they'd get married, and they'd still be posting cat pictures and puppy pictures. But once they had their first baby, there was no more cat pictures or dog pictures to be seen. It was just baby.
Yeah.
Because that greater love totally replaced that, well, maybe not totally replaced, but relativized to the extreme.
That's a good word for it. It relativized it. Yeah. Cause I think it's still there, you know. I mean, they're not stomping the dog to death once they have kids. They're, you know, they still love the dog. It's just you have a greater capacity. Dane, any final thoughts from you?
I'm not sure. If anyone's out there who's interested in apologetic series, that's coming up. Just be on the lookout for that. But I enjoyed chatting with you guys today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've got one final thought, sort of a funny thing that happened on the way to... I told one of you guys about this, maybe Sean, I can't remember, but... I was driving the kids to school and there was a bag of exploded trash in the middle of the road. Trash was everywhere. It's just debris. And I was like, oh man, some litterer chunked their trash up. But then as I got closer, I realized, no, it's not a litterer. There was a dead skunk body. For those that don't know, skunks like garbage. There's a dead skunk body hanging halfway out of the trash bag in the middle of the road. And I had this like flash. I was like, oh, this is a spiritual lesson. Like, you can get your head so buried in the garbage of this world that you don't see the calamity that's coming your way. You don't see the circumstances that are just going to steamroll you because you're so focused on the garbage of this world. And it made me think of Jesus's parable of the four soils, where he talks about the thorns and the rocks, and they can represent sins, but they also can just represent like distractions of this world that just get our eyes off of Jesus. And so I don't want to be that skunk. I don't want to have my head buried in the garbage, missing the, you know, what's coming. I want to be able to, I don't know. It kind of breaks down, but do you get the idea? Does that one work? Is that sort of a Devo? Maybe that'd be like a youth group Devo. That's probably about the level that one's for.
I don't ever want to see that as a children's book.
The skunk in the garbage bag.
He's dead, just like you're gonna be.
It's kind of too bad that he was a skunk, because, like, I don't know, that ruins the mystique of it. Like, if he was some majestic creature, like a unicorn or something, it'd be different. But a skunk, I don't know. Anyway, that's my final words. Hey, thanks for listening, everybody. And we're aiming at trying to do this weekly, so hopefully we'll talk to you next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
All right, see ya.